From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is off. I'm Bob Garfield. Hey, what if we were governed by a sinister foreigner masquerading as a native-born American, a real-life Manchurian candidate advancing a perverse plan to cull the population of the elderly? That's either a plot for a bad Hollywood thriller or this week in the Wingnutosphere.
I want to know, why are you people ignoring his birth certificate?
That's from a YouTube video of a Delaware town hall meeting with Congressman Mike Castle, a video that has flown all over the internet and cable news, fomenting right-wing rage over an imposter in the White House. Of course, the president has long since provided his birth certificate and contemporaneous Honolulu newspapers back in 1961 announcing his bouncing baby birth. But that's not good enough for the birthers, as they've come to be called. Some of them are fringe loonies. Some of them are members of Congress, such as the 11 Republican co-sponsors of a bill that would require future presidential candidates to present a U.S. birth certificate in order to run. And some of them are CNN's Lou Dobbs.
It's a lot of questions remaining, and seemingly the questions won't go away because they haven't been dealt with.
So demonstrably false is this rumor that even some of the most caustic media voices on the right have tried to squelch it, among them Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly, MSNBC's Joe Scarborough, and columnists Ann Coulter and Michelle Malkin. Still, with at least one poll showing that 58% of Republicans are not certain of the president's citizenship, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs was at pains to deal with the birthers this week.
The president was born in Honolulu, Hawaii, the 50th state of the greatest country on the face of the earth. There are 10,000 more important issues for people in this country to discuss.
Chief among those 10,000 issues is health care reform. But if Gibbs somehow believed the gravity of that matter guaranteed honest debate, he was sadly mistaken. It, too, was mired this week in a trumped-up controversy over a non-existent provision in the White House plan. Here on Fred Thompson's radio show is supposed health care expert Betsy McCoy.
One of the most shocking things I found in this bill, and there were many, is on page 425, where the Congress would make it mandatory, absolutely required, that every 5 years, people in Medicare have a required counseling session that will tell them how to end their life sooner.
Whoa, the feds culling the population of those burdensome elderly? That is shocking. Also, utterly untrue. The bill would simply allow seniors who do wish for professional advice on end-of-life issues, from will writing to hospice care, to get the government to pick up the tab. Yet the euthanasia canard was parroted by House Republican leader John Boehner and at least referenced by Fox News, CNN, The New York Post, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. That's interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that Betsy McCoy is the same person caught in a series of lies back in 1994 when she helped torpedo the Clinton health care initiative by claiming, falsely, that the plan would forbid citizens from obtaining private medical care. But of course, that was before the internet and the proliferation of 24-hour cable news, which is why writer James Fallows, who was in the forefront of debunking McCoy's claims 15 years ago, predicted on this program in May that nowadays, in a world of blogs and fact-checkers, McCoy wouldn't do so well. Fallows joins us once again. Jim, welcome back.
Bob, thank you. I'm sorry I'm sick this time, but I'll do my best.
All right, smart guy. What do you have to say for yourself?
I think if you compare this with 15 years ago, you do see a difference in the ecology of the news. Part of it, I think, involves Betsy McCoy herself, because this is now the third time she's gone out on a limb with something that just isn't true. But if you compare this with 15 years ago, where it took a long time, in fact, beyond the lifespan of the Hillary Bill Clinton healthcare proposal, to sort of come to grips with what was wrong with what she's saying, Now there's been almost an instant feedback loop. And I think the difference is, while the Limbaughs and the Fred Thompsons and even a few Republicans in the House are repeating this latest claim, it doesn't have the gravitas that her original one erroneously did have. And so I think there's something about the woman herself, but I think even more about the kind of instant feedback loop, which is the good side of the internet news cycle now.
Okay, fair enough. But I have to observe that the president was concerned enough about this disinformation that he felt the need to address an AARP town hall meeting to assure seniors that there are no federal plans to force them to euthanize themselves.
I think that illustrates a different phenomenon of the internet age, which is not so good. This same president also has to deal, or at least his team does, with the so-called birther claims that he was born in Kenya or someplace. And so just as the internet has made it possible for such mainstream organs as exist to do faster fact-checking, it also allows these kind of independent ecosystems of factual belief to persist. So I'm sure that just as the birthers will be there all the way along, I'm sure that there will be hearty reception for some of the latest claims that Ms. McCoy has made. And they have to be dealt with, but somehow it's different to have a question the president has to deal with than sort of mainstream conventional wisdom believing it.
So there's another issue here, a media issue of being in the Rolodex. Once you're in the Rolodex of TV producers, especially at cable news, it's kind of hard to get dislodged from it. CNN, which as recently as February was debunking McCoy's claims, recently had her on the air to talk about healthcare reform and identified her as a, quote, longtime expert in public health.
This is the sort of thing, and I say this jokingly, which makes me yearn for my days back in the Chinese-controlled state media when I was living there. There is a built-in problem with nonstop talk news. Number one, you need to fill every show and guests are cheap. Number two, you need to, quote, unquote, balance every show. So if you have some guy from the National Institutes of Health or the AMA, you need somebody on the other side. And there seems to be almost no extremity of being proven wrong, which disqualifies you from that role.
Every time I turn on cable news, I expect to see the boy who cried wolf to weigh in on the sheep situation.
That's a great example, because you could have an expert from the National Institute of Wolf Studies saying, well, as far as we can tell, there aren't any wolves. And then you get the boy who cried wolf, and it makes for an interesting cable discussion. So, yeah, and I think that one has to look for the good as well as the depressing in the evolving nature of the news. And I do maintain there is an element of good in the ability for faster detection of simple falsehood. That was hard to do in the 90s. It's easier to do now. But there's all this other stuff we have to worry about, too.
All right. Jim, as always, thanks for joining us, and take care of your throat.
Thanks very much, Bob.
James Fallows writes for The Atlantic and is author of Postcards from Tomorrow's Square, Reports from China. Here's one solution to combating conspiracy theories. Imagine you're at your computer and find yourself thinking, maybe he really isn't a U.S. citizen. And suddenly a hand reaches out of your computer, slaps you on the face, and shows you the birth certificate. A new Intel program isn't that exactly, but it's close. It's called Dispute Finder, and when downloaded, it scans what you're looking at online and shows you an article or blog that presents an opposing point of view. It aims to help you to get all sides of a controversial topic, even if you didn't know there was a controversy. It was created by computer scientists at Intel's research lab in Berkeley, California. Rob Ennals is one of the scientists there. He says Dispute Finder doesn't bombard you with every differing opinion on every single disputed subject. Rather, it chooses its topics and sources carefully.
Our intention isn't to tell you if everything is disputed, but more to tell you those things where the alternative point of view is backed by a source you'd be likely to trust.
So how is it customized for me in particular to have some sense of what sources I might trust or what sources I might consider lacking credibility?
So at the moment, this isn't in the current version, but what we're rolling out, when we show you some evidence, you can vote it up or down. So if you believe something is trustworthy from a good source you like to read, you can vote it up. Or if you believe it's from a source you don't particularly trust, you can vote it down. And from that, we can build a model of what kinds of sources you take seriously and want to see.
How do you avoid the echo chamber effect where if you are fed only news in a way that will corroborate your ideology?
That's a very good question. A lot of what we're trying to do with Dispute Finder is precisely to try and stop the echo chamber effect. But on the other hand, when we tell someone something is disputed, it's important to present it to them in a way that they will actually take seriously as actually being disputed. So let's say you're reading something on something like Fox, and it's disputed. It's far better to give you another conservative source to dispute it, rather than, say, the New York Times. We definitely want to be showing you the other side's point of view, but if we just give you the other side's way of writing it, you might be less likely to take it seriously. It's a delicate balance.
Is there a semantic web aspect of this that can actually read and understand the language that it's scanning?
The current version, everything is marked semi-manually. In the version we're going to be rolling out very soon, you train a artificial intelligence algorithm to be able to recognize when a piece of text in the web is making a particular disputed claim. Once the system is trained, the hope is then it will be able to go across the whole web and find a large proportion of the places in the web where that claim is being made.
Rob, I got to ask you this. On the video that describes how Dispute Finder works, the voiceover at one point says, oh, and we also have a bullshit detector. How is the bullshit detector an extra feature? The whole thing seems like a bullshit detector to me.
Actually, the bullshit detector is a thing we're planning to do next. It's trying to apply the same kind of ideas we're applying to the web to information you hear in real life. So let's say you're in a conversation with somebody and they tell you something which is disputed. The device is going to buzz in your pocket and let you know that you just heard something disputed and perhaps you should question it.
So if I'm listening to Rush Limbaugh or, let's just say, at Thanksgiving dinner, the thing's going to buzz right out of my pocket.
Yes. In fact, Rush Limbaugh will come earlier. So another thing we're planning to do before the bullshit detector, we want to apply this to closed caption TV text. And if some pundit on TV says something disputed, a thing will flash up at the bottom of your screen saying, this is a disputed claim. This source you trust disagreed and said this.
Rob, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rob Ennals is a research scientist at Intel's research lab in Berkeley, California, where he's developed the Dispute Finder. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hi, Jesse Thorne here, host and producer of The Sound of Young America. Our show's been such a successful podcast that some people don't know that it's also a nationally syndicated public radio show. So I pick guests who are relevant to the times we live in and really do their part to make a difference in the world. Like the band Au Revoir Simone.
I want you guys to know that I became interested in your music because the name of your band is an allusion to a line in Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
Yay!
Check out The Sound of Young America and a whole bunch of other podcasts at MaximumFun.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. It's been almost 6 months since President Obama signed into law the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, which you may know affectionately as the stimulus bill. And over the past couple of weeks, Republicans opposing the Democrats' health care reform proposals have been sticking to the talking point that be careful because the stimulus bill sure didn't work.
On the heels of the failed stimulus bill that added another...
We see
another,
that the stimulus isn't working, as your board rightly points
unemployment
out.
Unemployment stands at 9.5% and going higher. It's clear that the stimulus package didn't work.
The White House responded by saying, the stimulus bill is too working. Vice President Joe Biden pled his case last Sunday in an op-ed in the New York Times, wherein he pointed to recovery.gov, the White House's uber-transparent website advertised to track, catalog, and map how all the money is being spent. But is recovery.gov really as advertised? Does it even give the public, especially the reporting public, the data they need to follow the stimulus dollar? Eric Umansky, a senior editor at ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative news organization that's been covering the stimulus program, says, well, no.
You're talking about a massive bill, $700 billion plus, and it is incredibly difficult to track. The government itself has found it difficult to track, with various agencies giving various numbers and various status reports. If it's hard for the government to track, it's even more of a task for us to track.
For example, if you ask the Department of Agriculture how much of the package from its appropriation has been spent, they say, well, X number of dollars, but that could mean they're committed to spending the money. It could mean they've actually written a check.
Oh, absolutely. Each agency has its own definition for the status of where money is at in the process. Just to give you one example, you have money that has been appropriated, which is the first step. You have money that's been spent, and that would seem easy enough. And then you have this sort of murky middle ground called obligated. Obligated is, well, money that we plan on spending on a project and that we've committed to spending on a project, but we don't have the contracts yet. Well, one agency defines obligated in one way, another agency defines it in another way, and a third agency doesn't even use the same term. They use available. And so we've been pushing recovery.gov. We've been pushing officials at the federal level. I think they're getting some heat, and I think they might be getting the message.
At various points, you have tried to add up the different entries on recovery.gov to ascertain how much of the money has actually gotten into the economy. And nothing added up in any way, shape, or form.
No, you have recovery.gov numbers, and they are really making a great effort at this stuff, and they've committed an enormous amount of resources, so far as we can tell, to it. So it's no real criticism of them, except that the numbers don't add up in the end, because recovery.gov is getting their numbers from agencies, which in turn aren't sure about what the numbers are to begin with, and you find yourself in this circular logic of just trying to figure out a consistent number and spending hours and days at it.
These aren't academic questions. The whole point of the stimulus package was to get money out in the economy. Do you have any way of evaluating now whether the cash is actually flowing?
Yeah. In fact, this is obviously something we've been spending an enormous amount of time on. And one thing that we're doing and publishing on our site right now is what we call the stimulus progress bar. And that shows how much money is getting out the door. We've surveyed all the federal agencies and been talking with the folks at recovery.gov and tried to put it all into just one very simple bar chart that shows how much money is getting out the door. And the answer to how much money is getting out the door is, unfortunately, so far, not a whole lot.
Just a trickle.
Yeah. You know, you're looking at a huge backdrop of need. Against the need, there's not enough there yet.
When the government decides to pour, you know, close to $1 trillion into the economy, reporters, I think by nature, by instinct, by experience and training, look for the most preposterous pork barrel projects, you know, $18 million going to fund mascara research or some such thing. Are you looking for that kind of stuff, or are you just looking at the larger question as to whether the money's being spent, period?
You know, we're looking at both, and this has honestly involved a lot of soul searching on our part and thinking about this stuff very carefully, because what are the goals of this stimulus? Create jobs by, frankly, spending money quickly, but also spending money well. But if you just look for these outliers that you're talking about, if you just look for waste, not that those things aren't important to look at, but if you just look for those things, you risk missing the forest for the trees. In fact, you risk burning down the forest in the process. We've been very careful to look at potential waste, but also, frankly, to prioritize the notion of, well, how much money is getting out the door? And that's why we're doing things like I mentioned, like this progress bar.
Well, Eric, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Eric Umansky is a senior editor at ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative journalism organization that occasionally does reporting projects with WNYC Radio, the station where On the Media is produced. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is notoriously undermanned and overworked. It can take more than 2 years to get a judgment on whether an application is unique and not obvious. And sometimes the office's decisions can be suspect. Take, for example, granting a patent to Amazon for its ingenious one-click shopping idea, or to Smucker's for the crustless peanut butter and jelly sandwich. A few years ago, Beth Novick, a law professor at New York Law School, came up with an idea to open up the process to the public online so that experts and other inventors could help patent examiners determine which applications deserve approval. The Peer to Patent Project, launched in 2007, is now being evaluated to become fully institutionalized into patent office bureaucracy. Novak is now the Deputy Chief Technology Officer for Open Government in the Obama administration and has written a book about her experience creating the Peer-to-Patent Project titled Wiki Government: How Technology Can Make Government Better, Democracy Stronger, and Citizens More Powerful. Beth, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell me how the patent system traditionally has worked.
So traditionally, when an applicant puts in for a patent application and requests from the Patent Office a grant of 20 years of monopoly rights, in other words, 20 years to exclude all others from making, using, or selling that invention, the application goes to a patent examiner who has approximately between 15 and 20 hours to review the application, do all the background research, and write up his or her findings to determine if an application truly deserves a patent under U.S. law. And, you know, I don't know about you, but in 15 hours, I can spend 15 hours at work staring out the window sometimes. It's not a lot of time to determine whether there is nothing else out there like this application, such that it's so new and such an improvement over what came before that it truly deserves to get a patent.
Okay, so how does a peer-to-patent system improve on the status quo?
So what the peer-to-patent system does is it recognizes that the best expertise isn't always the official who sits in the patent office or who sits in any government agency. The person who has the best knowledge about, let's say, a new database technology or a new cancer-curing drug is going to be the person who's working in that industry. It's the graduate student who's writing his or her PhD around that topic. And so if we can tap the intelligence and expertise of those people, we can both speed up the review, but more important, we can get the best information available so that we're only enacting the best quality patent applications that truly deserve a patent.
In essence, you're crowdsourcing patent research.
Right. The exciting thing, and I think the thing that's different than the way some people think about crowdsourcing, is we're not simply leaving it up to the crowd to determine by mob rule whether an application deserves a patent. What we're doing is looking for information to help inform a considered process that will, in the end, be decided by the official in Washington, who can weigh all the information coming in and make a considered judgment in the public interest.
Okay, so a wiki, in many ways, is only as good as the last person to touch it. And what happens if the last person to touch the wiki on a given application is someone who has a financial interest in a new patent not being awarded?
It's an excellent question and one that we thought long and hard about when we designed the process. So in fact, it's not a wiki in the way that we're familiar with Wikipedia, where even in Wikipedia there are rules to prevent the kind of gaming you're talking about. What this is an open process that solicits very specific forms of information from people. In other words, earlier literature or products or inventions that may go to show that a patent application isn't truly new, asks the person submitting it to actually provide bibliographic information, you know, who the author is, when it was created, what date it was created, but does this all in an open way so that other people who've signed up to review the patent application can actually rate those submissions up or down in the sense of saying, is it relevant to the patent application at hand and how does it relate to the specific claims of the patent application.
But the fact that IBM and Microsoft have so enthusiastically applauded your project makes me a little nervous because they're big patent seekers themselves.
Well, they're also among those who get sued most often and hauled into court for patent infringement. So what we're trying to do here is to try to get this information into the process earlier to ensure that we're making better decisions. I think this example really applies across the board outside just the area of patents. When any government agency enacts a rule, whether it's to decide about the number of peanuts in peanut butter or the amount of asbestos in the air or water, we tend in government to draft those rules.
And then it's published in the Federal
Register,
and public comment is invited. Are you suggesting that that process really is outdated?
We're getting at input too late in the process to inform the writing of a rule. When we publish something in the Federal Register, we tend to reach lawyers in Washington, Beltway interest groups. I think that most of the techniques that we have now are outdated and inadequate to really match up to what's possible to do today in terms of engaging and involving people in their government to share their expertise and experience.
Beth, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Been a pleasure.
Beth Novak is Deputy Chief Technology Officer for Open Government in the Obama Administration and teaches law at New York Law School. Her book, Wiki Government, was published in April. In their quixotic quest to restore profitability, news organizations are turning their focus to those who have... Wait. News organizations and profits. Hey, Bernie, hit the jingle.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Last week, in an attempt to track down what it deems to be poachers, the Associated Press announced a plan to digitally track its content. Other news organizations, meantime, have formed a group called the Fair Syndication Consortium to figure out ways to recoup ad revenue earned by aggregators placing ads adjacent to linked content. Saul Hansel, staff writer for the New York Times, has been following this story, and he rejoins us. Saul, welcome to the show.
It's always great to be here, Bob.
All right, let's start with the AP. It said it's going to be sniffing out AP content all over the web. How's it going to do that? And then once it finds the stuff, then what?
The idea is they're going to digitally put a little bit of computer code into all of the AP stories that are syndicated on Yahoo News and Google News and all the newspaper sites. And every time somebody reads one of those articles, a little piece of the computer code will go call home, and AP will say, aha, this site was displaying our article. At a minimum, that is going to give them a census of all of the places that AP articles are displayed and how many times people read them. And that will in turn give them the chance to start marching against people who are using their articles that aren't paying for them and ask them for money, nicely or, in the case of the AP, often not so nicely.
Now, separately from the AP, there is a consortium of the New York Times, the Washington Post, Hearst, Reuters, Media News Group, McClatchy, and Condé Nast, the magazine publisher, that has hired a company called Attributor with a slightly different approach to the problem. Can you tell me what Attributor is supposed to do?
The key thing to understand here is this is something created by Attributor, and they have gotten these news organizations to sign on to look at it, and they have varying degrees of commitment. Here's what Attributor's scheme is for. They're trying to deal with the case where somebody copies an entire article from a newspaper or magazine and pastes it onto their blog or website and puts ads against it. Wholesale piracy. They're not messing around, at least in the first instance, with the question about what about a headline or just a little excerpt or a link. So what they have built is a specialized search engine that can crawl the web and find all the places that newspaper articles or magazines have been copied in totality. So their idea is go to the Googles of the world who put ads on all these blogs and say, hey, wait a second, Google, you're putting ads on the sites of pirates. That's not fair. So why don't you give some of that money that you would be giving to the pirates back to the newspapers? And then everybody should be happy. The pirates can run their sites. The newspapers can get paid for their content. Google and Yahoo and so on can be part of a law-abiding community, and the world will be a happier place.
Yeah, and let's just clarify the process by which a dinky little blog somewhere can actually have advertising attached to it that has been served by Google. Google has an automated system that any web publisher, no matter how large or small, can accept ads, often for very, very tiny remuneration. But in the aggregate, it amounts to real money, correct?
Indeed. And that's the whole theory here. It's not like you're finding a handful of sites that are stealing enormous quantities of news articles and making lots and lots of money. But the argument goes that all these little blogs in aggregate, each getting paid dollars a month by Google, total up to what Attributor says is $250 million a year.
Now, this all assumes that $250 million a year spread among all of those members of the consortium is going to amount to anything in their futures. It probably won't much. But if Attributor is right, and if the members of the consortium have bet right, Google will be asked to return to them some portion of the revenues that they have themselves aggregated from all of the hundreds of thousands of websites that they serve. Has Google given any indication whether it's going to sign on to this scheme?
Their official stance is they're reviewing the proposal. But as I talk to people who are very familiar with the advertising networks and the law, there is an enormous amount of skepticism. Google's customer are all those bloggers taking ads, and they want to do right by them. There is a big question about whether it is even legally appropriate for them to be put in the middle. So I think that there is going to be a big hurdle convincing the Googles and the Yahoos of the world to do this.
So I want to change the subject entirely to another way to monetize newspaper content, and that is to return to the notion of charging readers for reading, let's say, the New York Times on the internet. The New York Times company CEO Janet Robinson confirmed that there is a, quote, high likelihood of restoring a paywall on the Times website.
They have said publicly they're looking at two models. One they call the metered model, model after what the Financial Times in London does, which is gives their content free to anybody up to 10 pages a month or some such. And if you're one of the small number of readers who consumes the great number of pages, you'll be asked to pay to read it more regularly. But this is meant not to cut off the discussion where somebody gets linked in from a blog or something else where they can sample content and talk about it. That's model one. The second model is what I call the NPR model. All the basic content is free, but there is some level of membership that lets you feel part of something that might give you things like hats and t-shirts and insider access to something special, which is basically a way of saying, if you love the New York Times and want to support it and feel part of it, you can pay us money. But if you want to read Maureen Dowd or the White House coverage, that's still free.
For a donation of only $90 million, you can have the Boston Globe.
I'll bet you can get it for less than that.
I'll bet you can. Well, Saul, once again, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Bob.
Saul Hansel is a staff writer at the New York Times and writes for the Times technology blog, Bits. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. 2.5 years ago, Netflix set up a contest that offered a $1 million prize to whomever could figure out a way to improve its movie recommendation software by at least 10%. For years, amateur and professional computer scientists, statisticians, and psychologists have been trying to create an algorithm that knows whether you want to rent Borat or Tropic Thunder. But why would Netflix offer $1 million for such a small improvement?
Almost two-thirds of all movies they rent are picked because people had it recommended by the computer.
Clive Thompson writes for the New York Times Magazine and Wired.
Now, that seems like almost kind of crazy when you think about it, but it makes sense because, like, when I joined Netflix, I had, like, 20 movies I wanted to see. So I saw those. And once I'm done, I can't really think of any other movies I want to see. So if they want to keep on charging me $17 a month, they have to be active in helping me find new stuff, or I'll go 4 or 5 months without renting any movies, and they'll be like, why am I spending $17 a month, right? Their business model is incumbent upon keeping you renting movies.
That was actually from an interview Brooke did last year. At that time, all of the entries had stalled at around the 9% mark, and Thompson didn't predict that anyone would make it to 10% anytime soon. Brooke will take it from here.
Napoleon Dynamite. Why is that film significant?
Well, Napoleon Dynamite is really interesting because what happened is these guys, they came out of the gate and they were very quickly able to get like 5% better than Netflix. But it took like another 6 months to get to 6%. It took like a year to get to 7%. And they have been slowing down. It's almost like you're climbing a mountain that's getting steeper and steeper as you go. And so I asked them, I said, why? And they said, well, basically the problem is there's this small handful of movies that are causing most of our errors. You know, so like basically they're movies that we can't seem to predict whether or not you're going to like it. And it turns out that there's one movie that is generating 15% of the errors. Or so if you could figure out whether or not someone likes this movie accurately, you would be 15% of the rest of the way to making $1 million. And that movie is Napoleon Dynamite. They cannot seem to predict whether or not you're going to like it.
Because it's so weird?
Yeah, probably. It's all 5 stars and 1 stars. And when you have that sort of data signal, it's very confusing for the computer. It just cannot quite figure out how to recommend the movie.
What are the stakes if they can't master the art of predicting our tastes better?
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, you could say that they actually have enjoyed great success. They've already taken a lot of the things that these guys have figured out. They've already folded them into their recommendation system, so they're already going to start making millions more. But the reason why this is important is because you've got this media world where you have way more stuff than anyone can ever pick from. This is what they call the paradox of choice. If you have too many choices, you'll sort of get frozen. You'll choose nothing. Music is an even bigger problem than films because films, you know, a finite number come out every year, a couple hundred, a couple thousand. But, you know, that's as many songs as get issued on a day, right? So the music industry is to a certain extent, in even more of a lather to figure this one out because, you know, their industry is in a complete free fall and they're pretty convinced that the only way to cut through the noise is to be able to push people towards the right music. And so they have this very interesting heated argument about that falls along the same lines as to whether it should be done by computers or by humans, you know?
You quote in your piece someone who says, you know, there are cultural consequences to limiting yourself to computer data crunching to help guide people's opinions. It creates narrow-mindedness.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems is, and this is sort of an interesting philosophical point, whether or not you like a piece of culture may not be the most compelling reason to see it. You know, maybe there are other reasons to encounter culture other than whether or not you'd like it. Maybe it's almost like, you know, eat your beans. You know, you should pay attention to some of this stuff if you want to know what's going on in society. And so how in God's name are you going to get a computer algorithm to say, I'm going to recommend something that I'm pretty sure you won't like, but I think you should see?
Only your friends can get you to eat your beans.
That's right.
Clive, thank you very much.
No problem.
Clive Thompson is a writer for the New York Times Magazine, Wired, and Fast Company. Brooke spoke to him last year, but the contest has finally come to an end, and 2 separate teams managed to cross the 10% threshold. One, called Belcour's Pragmatic Chaos, did it a month ago, which set off a 30-day dash for other teams to one-up them. And members from various of those teams banded together to form the Ensemble. It came down to the wire with many new submissions from both Belcour's Pragmatic Chaos and the Ensemble. But Netflix has stopped receiving submissions, and it appears Belcour's is the winner, though the official winner won't be announced until September. Bob Bell is a scientist at AT&T and on Belcour's Pragmatic Chaos. He says there was no single insight that put them over that elusive 10% mark.
We tried to combine a lot of models together to get the best synergy. The first strategies looked at every possible pattern we might find in the data. One type of pattern that proved particularly effective is what we call temporal effects, which basically allow our users' interest and preferences to evolve over time. For example, as children mature, or perhaps with the addition of a new person to a user account. From a more technical perspective, we looked for ways to improve existing models that may have been developed by others, basically asking, are there ways to make this method work any better? And those typically lead to small differences, but small differences ended up being very important in the end.
Were you able to divine the problem with the status quo, with the original Netflix algorithms?
We haven't seen the details of their models. I think they used a method called nearest neighbors, which basically looks at, okay, what other movies like this one have you rated? And if you liked movies that are like this, we think you'll like the new one, but if there are other movies like this that you tend to give low ratings to, we wouldn't recommend it. And in fact, that's useful, but there are some more complicated techniques that go by a variety of names. The name I like to use for them is latent factor models, which allow for much richer description not only of movies, but also of users.
Latent factor models. You took the words right out of my mouth.
That's right.
So one of the cool things about the Netflix prize is that it has attracted people who were not necessarily the usual suspects. Had they gone out to hire consultants, they wouldn't have had so many people from so many disciplines getting involved.
Yes, I think what you're referring to is very important because in order to push this field forward, it really does need a lot of different perspectives. There were a lot of people working on this with backgrounds in computer science, but not necessarily from an academic perspective where a lot of the initial development of recommender systems came from, but simply people who are sort of hackers who said, this looks like a fun thing to do. I know something about movies. Maybe I can provide some good ideas. Chris Walensky, who's another team member, and I are both statisticians, but there were other people who by trade were psychologists, attorneys, unemployed, and whatever.
Are you a Netflix customer?
I am not. I don't watch a lot of movies. My wife watches more, and she tends to go out and just purchase them or occasionally watch them on TV.
So you approached this subject with complete academic disinterest. Has working on the project changed your behavior with respect to others? You know, you stop having conversations and just start trying to peer into people's minds to determine whether they're going to like Spider-Man 3?
No, it's had a lot of impact on how I approach other data analyses, but nothing substitutes just sort of talking to somebody and saying, well, what did you like about this movie? There'll always be a limit to what any computer model can do.
Bob, a tentative congratulations.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
Bob Bell is a scientist at AT&T and a team member of Bellcore's Pragmatic Chaos. The death of Walter Cronkite was announced shortly before 8 p.m. on Friday, July 17th. The longtime CBS Evening News anchor was an icon of the business, as big as it gets, really. But given our production schedule here at OTM, the news broke too late to be included on our show. And so we sat back that weekend and read the obituaries like everybody else and learned a great deal. Did you know, for instance, that Uncle Walter is so identified with the news business that in Sweden, an anchorman is called a Cronkiter? And speaking of anchorman, did you know that the word was coined in the 50s to define Cronkite's role on broadcast TV? Turns out, despite what many media eulogies would have you believe, neither of those facts I just asserted are exactly true. Ben Zimmer, executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus, traced some of the myths surrounding the man who was once the most trusted in America. He joins me now. Ben, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the Cronkiter bit. Read me, please, the excerpt from the AP obit.
Well, the obituary that ran in many newspapers came from the Associated Press. The version that ran in the Chicago Tribune, for instance, said Cronkite was the broadcaster to whom the title anchorman was first applied. In Sweden, anchors were sometimes termed Cronkiters, that's with a K. In Holland, they were Cronkiters, that's with a C.
It scans. I mean, it sort of sounds possible, but what you did was go back to see if it was, you know, true. What did you discover?
Well, I was not able to discover any evidence in Swedish, Dutch, or any other language that news anchors were ever called Cronkiters. So I tried to figure out, well, who started telling this anecdote? And when I first looked, the earliest example I could find was in a 1978 book called Airtime, The Inside Story of CBS News, written by Gary Paul Gates, who was at one time a news writer for Cronkite. Then in 1979, David Halberstam wrote The Powers That Be, and similarly he had, in Sweden, anchormen were known as Cronkiters. It seemed that these were the earliest examples of this story being told, and what I did was I actually contacted Gary Paul Gates to find out where he got the story from, and it turns out he says he got the story from Halberstam.
Unfortunately, David Halberstam died about a year ago, and you cannot go to him to find out where he came up with it. Now, let's assume that he did not make this up out of whole cloth, that somebody in Sweden at some point, maybe in a newspaper column or whatever, referred perhaps puckishly to one of their news presenters as a Cronkiter. But what process do you suppose that what may have begun with a single episode has come to be conventional wisdom in the obituary sphere for Walter Cronkite?
Well, I think that this is a classic example of an anecdote that's simply too good to check. And since the late 70s, when it was first reported by Halberstam and Gates, it was picked up and embellished along the way. And in the 80s, Holland entered the picture. But this, similarly, does not have any evidence to support it, so that if you ask a native speaker of Swedish or of Dutch, hey, so a news anchor is called a Cronkiter in your language? They'll say, what are you talking about?
Now, this is not an answer you give lightly. You have testimony from an actual Swede, do you not?
Yes, there is something that I wrote on a blog called Language Log, and one of my readers was Swedish and chimed in on this and said, I, Swede, 66, multilingual professional translator, have never seen or heard that word in any language. He went on to say that he was afraid that Mr. Cronkite is totally unknown by an overwhelming majority of Swedes.
Okay, so much for Cronkiters. How about the term anchorman itself? Anchormen, I guess, originally were men who hoisted anchors. I know in tug of wars, or would that be tugs of war, the guy at the end of the rope is the anchor man. Was Cronkite indeed the first news host to get that title?
Well, there's a bit more truth to this story than the Cronkiter story. It is fair to say that the word anchorman was applied to Walter Cronkite beginning with the National Political Conventions of 1952. And it's really the sense of anchorman that we're familiar with, someone who's coordinating between the different news reporters and serves this sort of central pivotal role. But he was not the first person in television to be called an anchorman. There were certain figures on panel shows. So, for instance, the quiz panel show Who Said That featured John Cameron Swayze, who himself was a news commentator, and they called him the anchorman of that panel. And similarly, for news panel shows, there were certain correspondents who were the sort of important correspondents on that show. One was Griffin Bancroft on the CBS show Capital Cloakroom. They called him an anchorman in 1950. So that's 2 years before Cronkite.
Lawrence Spivak, Meet the Press?
Lawrence Spivak from Meet the Press was also referred to as an anchorman in early 1952. So by the summer of 1952, when Walter Cronkite was sort of being introduced to the nation, and this was a very important broadcast, it was the first time that the political conventions were being telecast from coast to coast. They were very exciting conventions because there was real doubt about who would be nominated in these conventions. So he got a lot of exposure in the summer of 1952, and he was introduced as the anchorman of the broadcast. That really did popularize the usage, but it's too much to say that it was actually coined for him. And whoever actually first called Cronkite an anchorman, generally it's held to be Sig Mikkelsen, who was the president of CBS News at the time, must have been drawing on these earlier uses coming out of panel shows and that sort of thing.
Okay, now there were a couple other things widely reported about the life and career of Walter Cronkite. Was he indeed the most trusted man in America, or did, you know, someone make that up too?
Well, that one's a little shaky also. The whole idea that he was the most trusted man in America came from a poll that was done in 1972, where the poll company wanted to determine the trust index of various public figures. And so they had mostly politicians on this list, including Richard Nixon and various others. And so Cronkite beat out the politicians because generally people don't think of politicians as very trustworthy.
But nobody asked about Sandy Van Oker.
Nobody asked in that survey about John Chancellor of NBC, Harry Reasoner of ABC. So we don't actually know how he would compare at that time with these other news hosts. But from then on, he was simply known as the most trustworthy figure in America based on that poll.
I hesitate to ask you for the moral to this story, but you know, you have to see the irony in the idea that the death of one of the most important figures in television news has been widely reported with, you know, scant regard to the actual facts. That's got to have a meaning larger than the particulars, no?
I think it does, and I think that we can best honor the great legacy of Walter Cronkite by making sure that this kind of reporting is accurate and is trustworthy. And in fact, the Cronkiter story had been repeated by Walter Cronkite himself in his own memoirs. even Walter Cronkite, trustworthy avuncular Walter Cronkite, needs to be checked out to make sure everything is really factual.
Well, Ben, thank you very much.
Well, great. Thank you for having me.
Ben Zimmer, and by the way, Zimmer is the Dutch word for authoritative, is executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus online at visualthesaurus.com. Oh, and Zimmer is not actually the word for authoritative. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Sarah Fidelibus and Kasia Glodke, and edited by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. And finally, this. On Sunday at Washington's National Cathedral, a memorial service for Stone and Holt Weeks, two young men killed in a highway accident last week. Stone and Holt were the sons of our dear friends Jan and NPR colleague Linton Weeks. Both young men were research assistants to scholars at Rice University, and both had a deep and abiding interest in the world beyond their own remarkably rich lives. This show is dedicated to their memory. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.